In the 13th century, Genghis Khan led the Mongols to establish the largest land empire in history. After his death, it divided into several successor states, known as the Horde, that controlled most of Eurasia. You may know Genghis Khan as the leader who conquered the world, but in truth, the Horde changed the world. A brilliant French historian, Marie Favreau, shows us how in her book, The Horde, and also shows us in a new exhibition in France. On the Burning Archive today, I am speaking with Marie Favreau about how the Mongols, men and women, changed the world and how their history helps us understand our globalized world today. Welcome, Marie, to the Burning Archive podcast.
Hey, hi.
We're here to talk about your wonderful book, The Horde, How the Mongols Changed the World. And you're talking to me from Paris, yes,
where you absolutely
live and work. And it's been quite an adventure getting to this point for us, but a few detours through Montreal and all the rest of it. But very, very pleased we finally got there. I've got a whole series of questions about the Horde, but the first thing that really personal question just to ask you was I'd heard that you published this book or wrote this book first in English rather than French. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. It's actually, it's really part of the way I build up like my research. I moved to different areas because, you know, in France, it was not a tradition in universities to work on the Mongol Empire, and especially on the Golden Horde, which is the western part of the Mongol Empire, what that is Russia, basically, today. And so I had to move. And I spent a lot of time in Oxford with colleagues working on other types of nomadic empires, so empires run by nomads. And there, so our common language was English, although they were coming from everywhere, but that was our common language. And so I decided to work in English and write in English at that time. And the funny thing is, recently I had to translate my book in English into French, which was a very strange exercise, but you know, but it's good to work with translation too. And then I rediscovered my work in a way by, you know, moving from a language to another.
Yeah, that's right. And the linguistic element of this book is fantastic too, because you use some of the Mongol, is Mongol the right term for the language? You use some of the Mongol words, including the title of the book.
Yeah, that was very important for me to find my own language also, like which terms I wanted to explain to the public, to the students. So actually, the work I do with the student is very helpful because I see where we have to stick to some terms and how to explain them. Sometimes it's good to translate. Sometimes it's good to use empire. But when you know that Mongols never use this term for themselves, of course, it's also interesting to see what are the terms they want to use in their official documents. And that's where I come up with Horde, which is a term, Orda, Ordu. I mean, the pronunciation a bit different, but this is the actual term the Mongols use. So we really had to promote it, you know?
Yeah. And I guess the one thing everyone sort of knows, so to speak, about the Mongol Empire is, you know, Genghis Khan, you know, and the almost universal image people have is, you know, marauding armies on horseback, you know, seeking world domination. Yeah. And that is absolutely not the story you tell in your book. Yes. Who were the Horde, the Mongols, and then specifically the Horde, who were they? What were they really like? Because your book really flips the script, I guess, on who they were really like.
Yeah, that was my idea. That was really important. So first, the interesting thing is I didn't start with this preconceived idea that, oh, I'm going to revise the whole story. This just what I was in seeing in my sources, like written sources, archaeology. I tried to use everything, and I realized they're much more than just war, and there are no like the idea that they destroyed entire population and destroyed completely and cities is. But this is not directly my work. But my colleagues in archaeology, they all say no, they destroyed some of them, and the war happened. But the level of destruction is was amplified in different sources for a number of reasons. So my point, I think, was also it's coming from discussion with my student. Why would they go out of what is basically Mongolia today, where the Mongols lived in the 12th century with Genghis Khan? And why they renegotiate their relationship with their neighbors, how this whole process of the conquest, how to describe it, seeing what we see in the sources. And I discovered that there was no grand plan of conquering the world or things like this, that they wanted to trade differently. They wanted to be recognized as, leaders among nomads first. So they were very much after nomads, much more than after sedentary people. So the idea that, these nomads are raiding cities, they want the wealth of the cities, this is just, a late construction. So that's one aspect. The other interesting aspect that I could see in my sources is how after the war of the conquest, they completely transform Central Eurasia, and how they transform the trade connections, all the rules of exchange also among nomads with what is China today, of course the Russian principalities were in, but also with Europe, especially Northern Europe. So I was extremely interested in describing this, analyzing it, and also I realized that I heard before, well, okay, then the Mongol, they open up, but thanks to the foreign traders, like Italian traders, really the rules of exchange became modern in a way. But actually, you can see that no, Mongols were behind all those changes, that they were super conscious of what they were doing and that they themselves changed the rules.
In fact, you describe them as, I think the term you use is expert administrators, or I mean, you could say like skillful politicians, I guess, rather than these sort of armies.
Yeah,
And that
it's
really
true.
struck me that it was about their political, I don't know, political genius is too big a term, but they're very skillful diplomats and governors.
Yeah, they were very good at recruiting the good person for the good position. Like, for instance, when they want administrators, they would go for traders because traders, they speak usually different languages. Usually they know how to write and they can use different scripts and they know how to count. And counting is key, if you want to organize what they're going to do, like use huge taxation system, build on what people produced, and there are all those communities producing, agriculture in agri some are working on agriculture, others are herders. You have those traders, you have a lot of craftsmen, also religious people who have their own statues. So this very complex organization, they were able to run it for like 2 centuries and even 3 centuries when you look at the western part of the Mongol Empire. So it's extremely interesting, I think, to because we have documents, we have coins, we have many things that can help us to understand how they manage this diversity. I think for us today it's really impressive. We are so monolith. I mean, states is a monolith today, and look at their state. It was so, it was like a patchwork, but with good combination. So that's what I wanted to show.
I guess if Chinggis Khan is, or Hun is the best known Mongol leader, perhaps the for most people the only sort of known Mongol leader. You sort of introduce him in the book, but you introduce him in a kind of a when he's first introduced in the book, it's in a slightly different way because you present him talking to this sort of Taoist priest, I guess. Is that the right term?
A Taoist
Or
monk. Absolutely, Taoist monk. And I wanted to show that Genghis Khan actually was got a lot of ideas about how to deal with a new subject in his newborn empire, and that how he was so interested in negotiation, how he managed diplomacy, and how also he managed, that's what I just said about taxation and religious diversity, to give some religious elites some sort of freedom to practice their own religion and also to organize their own community, not to pay taxes, and not to go to war, no conscription for religious clergies, monk, priest. This is important because it explains how some of the his new subjects, Muslim, Taoist, Buddhist, and Christian, agreed to be ruled by the Mongols, because actually it was a fair deal for them. And I also wanted to show that, okay, this is what happened from the Mongol side, but look at the subject also side, and why would they accept, seeing that the Mongols are just a few men, if you compare, if the balance, demographic balance, it's no good for the Mongol. So they cannot rely only on violence, force, and coercion. They have to convince people that the system is good, that the Mongol order is a good order. And then this is one key aspect, the one the way they deal with these religious communities since the time of Genghis Khan. That's what I wanted to show. Although also the important I think I wanted to show is that it's not only Genghis Khan's work. It's like I like very much the collective aspect, which I discovered also in my sources. He's so famous, he's a hero. So we always focus on him. But it's not just him. It's like the whole family, it's the people, the friends around him, plus of course all the people they hired, and his administrators, all the people around the one we call Mongol, actually.
Yeah, I mean, could you say a bit more about that? Because that's a big theme of the work too, isn't it? The this it, that it's I mean, part of being skillful politicians was the fact that they were that they didn't just, say it's my way or the highway. They sort of worked as a collective, and it was they had sort of quite strong sort of political institutions of sort of collective decision making sort of institutions, if I read the book correctly.
They do. So the kind of question I had when I was start working on this was, okay, do you have a ruler? So it's Genghis Khan. After him, it will be a son, and there will be many successors in his own lineage. So we call them Khan or Khan. How they manage to govern their empire, how they manage with the different elite, nomadic elite, living far away, seeing that the empire is so big because it covered at at the end of the 13th century, it covered most of Eurasia. So he had the Khan had the council, so a number of people around him helping him in kind of everyday governing. That's one thing. But the other interesting thing is they had what we call the Kurultai or Hurilte, a big assembly, and this big assembly were convened twice. We think twice a year, at least once a year, but sometimes twice a year. Mostly probably at the spring season, and they during this moment, so nomads would come from everywhere in the empire. All the important nomadic families come, not only men, a lot of women too, all the important nomadic lineage, a Mongol nomadic lineage. So some would come from 1,000 kilometers away, like from Western Russia to Mongolia. They would organize their discussion, and they really say that at the moment when decisions are taken, war, peace, big marriage, trade, big trade contract, trial, if you need, a special trial, also that could be the moment. This is a moment for taxation, organization, and things like this. So, and they're really clear on the fact that they really need these face-to-face moments. So although they are so far away, there's a moment they really have to be together. And this, it's not just one day assemblies last usually for weeks. Interestingly, so it's in that the spring season probably or summertime. It's the moment when the Mongols stop conquering, stop fighting, so just sit and talk. And I think this seasonal thing is super interesting. The fact that in summertime or springtime, it's a moment everything stop, and it makes sense when you're herders because you have your herds, you have the lactation time and everything. So the animals need to rest, and they really follow the rhythm of the animal in that sense. So, and winter is time for like a trade everywhere, a war if necessary, a moving. It's traveling time. It's winter. And when you know how cold the winter can be still
Yes.
today, you know, in northern, you know, Eurasia, this is crazy. You imagine like this is very cold winter, and the Westerners and the Muslim also from the Middle East were super surprised by this organization. And this explain a little bit, it's part of their success during the conquest, because in Latin Europe, you don't do war during winter. In the Russian principalities, you don't do war during winter. So they were really puzzled, and that's really the Mongol rhythm that you know. My student always say, "Well, but it's very hard to move with all the animals during winter with the snow. How they did it?" But no, in fact, we have to think about Eurasia and all those big river valleys and all of those frozen rivers during winter, and that's the best moment because they are frozen. So it's like, you know, a highway. You can put your carts, you can put, you know, you can have the camels, and you can walk fast and cross Eurasia. That's the only way, in fact. So,
I think I heard you in an interview say how you traveled to various places within what used to be the Horde's territories, just to sort of get a feel for, well, how would you move around this sort of territory as well?
I think it's very important for, although I'm a historian, for, you know, it's Middle Ages, so we can think, oh, everything should happen now in the archives, which is true. I mean, you have to go to the archives when you're a historian, but you also have to see the places you describe. You have to understand also the geography by seeing it. We know some areas have changed, of course, but still, it gives you an idea. It gives you an idea of how a distance that on a map sh look like a short, simple travel, simple journey, and you have to walk, and then you see, oh wow, there are those hills. In fact, it's super dry, and there's a lot of, you know, a wind in this area, and in fact walking is takes forever. So in a map it looks like nothing, so it gives you really a different perception of the landscape. And I always say to my student, yeah, landscape is a source for us too. We have to go. And also, of course, well, we have to visit our, you know, archaeologists working on different sites and monuments, and as much as possible, we have to see them.
Going back to the story, I guess the story of the Horde, like in, I guess, the popular kind of histories of the Mongol Empire, the sort of story ends kind of with Genghis Khan, really, and you really sort of take it all from there. What's the broad, and I guess people are used to kind of rise and fall of empire type stories, and you tell a sort of a different, it's a bit of like a chameleon. It keeps sort of changing. The nature of the Horde state sort of adapts and changes over time. So how would you
Absolutely.
describe the sort of story arc from, Genghis
Yeah,
Khan
that
to the end
yeah.
point?
Yeah, that's also something in very interesting when you work on those nomadic empires and organization. You see how much they are able to adapt themselves and change. So the Horde is, so my focus in my book is really the western part of the Mongol Empire. So it means people coming, nomads coming in the early 13th century, first half of the 13th century, coming from Mongolia towards Eastern Europe, and basically having their headquarters and centers around in the lower Volga today, which is like near maybe the city of Astrakhan. In this area, but it's remaining nomads, so seasonal dip movements, mobility, and but also leaving their home native region, right? And although we have this idea of this big step, well, no, they are different kind of step, and it's different. If you go now today, you can travel to Mongolia, enjoy there the steppe, which is can be very different in if it's central or if near the Gobi or in the north. And then if you go to southern Russia, you'll see another type of steppes and another type of landscape. So it's flat basically. So, but still, they had to adapt to live there. It's not because they were the new master that it was easy to adapt. So I was interested to see how they managed to, first of all, how they really sort of develop the. So they have tents, nomads with big round tents. We call ger in Mongolian today, or yurt in Turkish language. And these tents, they would put them on cards. And they would roll, push the cart and use the animals, mainly probably oxen and camels sometime horses, to pull these big carts, or carts with tent on them. And it's because it's very flat, so they can move like this. And they would not dismantle the tents. They would just take it and put it on the ground when they need to stop. So I start working on how they move, and I realized they move very slowly with all the families, with the animals, with the craftsmen. Everybody move. No, it's so what we call a horde today is not it's not appropriate to what it was at that time, because it's not a bunch of excited warrior. It's all the nomadic people were walking together, rather slowly along the river. With the cards, the animal, the tent, lots of boxes. They carry a lot of things. Also, women are in charge with conducting, all this. And we have description on how they manage to cross rivers, how they move, how when they decide to move from a camp to another. Yeah, so that's a first a very interesting way to adapt to a new. Completely new landscape. And then also they adapt to the relationship with their sedentary subject. They're mostly the Russians in this area, but there were others, Armenians also, Italians, Venetians who came later, and how they decided not to walk on their ground because, agriculture needs, a special arrangement. So if nomads go there, it's bad. So they also have a vision of their territory, and they manage to have different territory. I mean, way of living on the same in the same area. So I think it's extremely interesting. We don't have so many examples today of a state with basically two major different way of living: nomads on one side and sedentary people on the other side, living peacefully together. So I think it's interesting. And then they adapt because the world around them changed. And in Europe, things change. The fragmentation of all these Christianities transform. In Hungary, the neighbors, the Kingdom of Hungary become stronger. The rise of what we call Poland-Lithuania, rise of what we will call later Russia as well. So, and then the Ottoman arrived, blocked the Black Sea. How do they react to this? So I was super interested in seeing when there's a problem around them, also to how they organize themselves and how they fight back or how they retreat, which is something I developed in my book, the ability to retreat, to withdraw when necessary. And that's how they survived, I think, until the in some areas until 16th century.
And you also, I guess, tell the story in the book about how what Europe and Europeans perhaps still perceive as the horde invading Europe to, loot and dominate, etc., is really more about control of these different sort of nomad the different groups across the steppe of the different nomads. It's more about the sort of, I guess, internal politics of the steppe rather than envy of Europe, if I would,
Yeah,
could put it that way.
that's true, because there's a big question. When you work on the Mongol Empire, you can be surprised that after in the second half of the 13th century, on one side, on the eastern side, Mongol will continue to advance, to go towards, like expansion, because they will conquer Thousand China, Song China, at the end of the 13th century. But if you look at the west, of the Mongol Empire, or the part on which I work, well, then you see that basically after the, even in around the 12 early 1260s, they stop trying to conquer. They just organize their relationship with their neighbors. So they have treaties with the Byzantine Empire, for instance, and also they exchange a lot of letters with kingdoms in Europe, like French Kingdom, England. We know they send embassies. We have letters, exchange their views about the world order and exchange gift, and they want to trade. So actually, it's the idea that the Mongol are always in this push for expansion and are only conquerors. It's not accurate, especially on this western border. And I found very interesting to see how they transformed their energy to conquer, which was there clearly, into a trade energy, which is also a form of, trade can be, there's violence in trade. We know that. I mean, it's not like, peaceful, it's necessarily like means peaceful relationship, but still it's a more constructive way to, face other people and build up. So you have to build up something. And the Mongols were very good at building up over generations, bonds over generations. Although they can be flexible in their alliance, but still there's always this memory of, we were allied with your father or your grandfather, or we know each other since one century, so let's keep on. And this is super interesting to see, and I think rather fascinating for also other smaller polities like kingdoms in Europe to see how Mongols like continue, they go forward and they continue what they start building under Genghis Khan. Although there are also tension among Mongols, tension among lineages, and sometimes tension about among sovereigns, it makes sense. But at the same time, politics is there. So if they invest in research, like they invest in astronomy or in producing manuscripts or sciences or some type of agriculture or trade, they will continue to invest over generation. And that's also, I mean, super special for the Middle Ages.
And who are some of the kind of leading figures in the story of the Horde, after Genghis Khan, that we perhaps should know more about as a result of your book?
There are several, actually. So, of course, just after Genghis Khan time, almost, Batu was his grandson, the son of his eldest. He's really was able to lead the expansion towards, Eastern Europe. So he's a key character, and he's the one who decided also to stay in what is Western Russia today, and not to go back to Mongolia, so around 1250 something. So this is also a very key moment when they decide, okay, we stay there, it's ours now, it's our step, new step. And then after, of course, his brother Berke, who decided to also convert to Islam, which is also super interesting, also first Mongol rulers converting to Islam, and how Islam will remain in this part of the Mongol Empire extremely important in terms of the numbers, of course, of Muslim communities there, but also the relationship they will build with the Mamluk Sultanate in Egypt and Syria at that time, a relationship that will last until the 15th century, so really long-term one. And but also how from that moment on they will still remain open to other religious communities, because although Khan can convert to Islam, and it will happen several times after Berke, we'll have several cases of Muslim Khan, Mongol, but at the same time, often their wives, the Khatun or princes, were Christian and sometimes Buddhists. and how also we know they accommodate all sorts of communities, Jewish communities, Armenian communities, Dominican and Franciscan, especially. Friars also had their own community there in the Horde in this western part of the Mongol Empire. So this is extremely important, you know. And then, so after I was happy to look at the women characters, women figures who are important in the Mongol period, because women princesses and hatun, as we call them, nomadic elite, women, they really also participate in governing, administrating. They participate in also during diplomatic receptions. They are there. The ambassadors come to visit them, offer their gift to the queens, and the Mongol queens are visible. So for Muslim travelers or Christian travelers, this is most shocking, you know, to say how visible they are and how strong they are. So I was also happy that, because I found in my documents some several cases of strong women to show how they participate and what happened to them. We also have you know, a whole lot of discussion about how Mongols might give some princes to marry abroad, and we have one case of one Mongol princess marrying the Mamluk sultan. So I work on this case too in my book to show how complicated it was and how the Mongol didn't like the idea of sending, because this princess is very high standing from Genghis Khan lineage, sending them away to marry far away was a lot of required a lot of negotiations and how it was complicated. So I like to show also how diplomacy is like a big effort from both parts. It's not just friendship. It's like you really have to have translators, to really have to explain from one culture to another what something means, because the meaning can be different in a culture or another and things like this. So I'm happy to show in my work the effort it is to build up diplomacy, peace, trade, that it's not easy. We know it's not today, but imagine at that time, you know.
Yeah, totally, totally. There was a figure whose name I can't remember, who was particularly crucial to sort of the connection between the Horde and the forging of the sort of Russian principalities.
In the
Was that
there were the
Batu or
there were several. The thing is, with the Russian, it's interesting, because actually for the Mongols, the Russian were their subject, and they were their very important subject. And so they, the Russian princes married Mongol princess, and but that was not sending the princess away. It mean they were part of the family, and the Russian princes, they were supposed to come and visit the Khan, the hordes inside the nomadic court. You know, they were supposed to go there on a regular basis, and they would stay sometime months. We even have case of, you know, years staying with the Khan. But I think it's really key, because we understand how politics work under the Mongol. The fact that this face-to-face relationship discussion, that's what they want also with the Russian princes. So when we think that, oh, it's two worlds, they were not connected, they didn't know each other, it's not true. Certainly they did know each other. They, in many ways, respect each other. We don't have so many, there were tensions sometimes, but there were also a lot of moments when they were at peace. When we see when tensions occurred in the Russian principalities with Mongol, like coming and raiding or destroying a city, usually it's because the Russian prince had troubles with another prince and asked the Mongols' army to support his claim. And so they were involved in Russian politics, and they were involved in Russian politics as if the Russian were part of the Mongol family, well, not as, you know, like if it was a frontier or something. So we also know that many Christian princes, Mongol princes, were in favor of, you know, metropolites and Russian priests, who also were used often in their diplomatic relationship with Byzantium. They would be sent there and they would support Mongol claim. So it's really entangled world. I think how they communicate, it's a good interesting question I have often from my students. I think they were several languages were used. They would Mongol language was still spoken until the 14 end of 14th century, but Turkish, a Turkish language that we call Kipchak language, was used already before the Mongols by nomads and known by some of the Russians. So this was also a medium for discussion, and maybe also some Russian language was known by some Mongols. There were a lot of, I mean, it's very interesting to see that how often messengers were exchanged, people trade together, how they communicate often. So they clearly had, you know, this ability to switch from a language to another.
I've read quite a bit about Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Fourth, Ivan the Terrible, over the years, and one of the things I remember from the biography of him is that some people think he spoke some of the Tatar languages because he grew up with the sort of the Chinggis sort of Tatar princes in his sort of I don't know what court. And I think he married one of his like seven wives or something was from the Nogai family, I think. So yeah, there you go. So
You're right,
quite
exactly.
long lasting.
Yeah, absolutely. Because actually, Ivan Grozny was really at his time, I mean, the major entity, like the major power, the reference was the Mongol Empire, clearly. It was one of the biggest thing the Russian have experienced, you know. So we know that the legacy is huge. He clearly speaking their language. So we say Tatar. And the name is used already in the 13th, 14th century. Then it's actually it's for the Mongols, used for the Mongols. And it's in many sources when you see Tatar, it means Mongol. But the language can be sometimes some form of Turkish language, like Kipchak language, and that the one that the language Tatar people use today. So this Muslim population living in what is Russia now, in actually Crimea and also Lower Volga, Middle Volga, in fact, Middle and Lower Volga, and the Tatar population. They still say this is, I mean, the period of the Horde. They call it the Golden Horde. The Mongol Empire period was a key period for us because it's a period when many people were, you know, also converted to Islam, and it's an peak of, you know, culture. Also, their urban and also urban Muslim culture was important already in the 13th, 14th century in this area. So this is very interesting. Actually, when I it's funny because when I start working on the Horde, my first idea was to understand Islamization in some areas of Russia. So I really wanted to understand how Islam came to Russia. When I was a student, I was fascinated by that because for me, Islam was something that I associated with the South, with, you know, southern part of the world, with Middle East. And suddenly I discovered there's a Northern Islam. And so what is this Northern Islam? I was fascinated. And then I discovered this happened during a Mongol period. And it was like, what? The Mongol brought Islam to Russia. I was like, what is that? So that was, and then still I'm very happy to work on this because this is an extremely interesting question, you know, how the Mongol transformed completely the balance of power between Christian and Muslim. And actually we have this idea that they destroyed Baghdad and the Abbasid Caliphate, but they reconstruct a lot already in the end of 13th century and the 14th century. They clearly support Islam in many ways. So it's really not enough known, I would say, and very interesting.
You use this idea of the Mongol exchange, which I guess compares the cultural, physical, economic, population movements across Eurasia with like the Columbian Exchange, same sorts of things between America or Europe and America, or I guess the rest of the world and the Americas. What's your idea of the Mongol Exchange, and I guess how significant is it as well? How does it show the real significance of the Mongols and the Horde in human history, world history?
Yeah, that's a very important concept that I worked on with also other colleagues, but I maybe I'm the one who developed it the most. The idea was to work on the not only on the Mongol Empire, but on the way they reached the outside world and the impact their organization had on the outside world and actually on most of what is the world what the known world at that time, let's say for the European and for the nomads in Eurasia. So my idea was to show that this new rules of exchange, like trade exchange, new circulation, new road, they open the fact that you could cross a great part of Central Eurasia without being harmed with caravans and traders. The also exchange between religion, arts, between science. We know so much about now how really science transformed at that time. I wanted to show that this is clearly part of the Mongol legacy, and this cannot be just how can I put that? Like this is not just the Mongol Empire. It's them with the others, and I thought that the Columbian Exchange was a great example to show how you there's not only one relationship, or there's not it's not only about the European clearly, and even just some population in the America. It's much more than that, and there are a lot of stuff they don't control. You don't know what this is, how this is going to develop, and the Mongol are not in control of what they are doing, and they have no idea about the legacy. And I think that's interesting to show that there's part of control, but there's something that is really not in your hand, even though you're the most powerful empire in the world. So that's what I wanted to work on that. Also, I did not use so much the term Mongol peace, Pax Mongolica, which is super well known, but because we always focus on peace, and that's not my idea, because as I said, on this exchange, there's also violence and there are tensions, and it's important to show that too. Like, we don't want to, depict a ideal world, and, which is because this is not accurate. So it's interesting to see how this time, although it's clear when you look at horses that it's almost a form of globalization, and one of the earliest in history, one of the most powerful one, an amazing phenomenon, and that how much was disregarded and not studied and not known while we are all in it. I actually in France now we are studying more and more the Mongol period because it's also our period in history because it's globalization. We are in it, and when you see that Mongol, textiles are still in the museum in Paris from that period, that the first relationship between a French king like Philip the Fair and a Mongol ruler is 13th century. That we still read Marco Polo, who was certainly a Venetian trader, but also an administrator for the Khan for 20 years. So you see how enmeshed we are in our past with this period of history. And I think Mongol exchange give a better idea of what how big this was and how tentacular and how transforming this was.
It's interesting what you say about globalization, because I just finished reading this book by John Darwin about, I think it's Unlocking the World, the about steam globalization. And I've also read his book After Tamerlan,
After
which is
Tamerlan, sure, me
brilliant
too.
book.
Brilliant, yeah.
I guess he makes the point that there have been many different types of globalization over the year. The sort of story that people getting their heads, you know, from the 1990s that, you know, it all began in 1991 is not really accurate that there have been globalizations like the Mongol Exchange, et cetera.
I think actually the world history is like this. There are moments when things open up and moments when door close everywhere. And this is from antiquity and probably even earlier, though we need sources to document it, but we know that. And it's fascinating to see how come at some point, at some moment, things like roads are open and people can, you know, exchange, and how quickly this can stop and be forgotten, you know. So I think that's also like kind of for us today, when you see, we all experience that as historian. There are places where you cannot go anymore because there's war or because there are too many political tensions. And although for many years you went to some place and suddenly it's over, you cannot go anymore. This is really like dramatic and terrible and consequential. And this also should, you know, I think it's interesting to look at the past with what we know today.
I wanted to ask you because, like, your book says how the Mongols or the Horde changed the world. How do you think world history needs to change with all the insights that you've gathered with all your colleagues, etc., now about the Horde and I guess also about nomad empires, I guess, as well? What are some of the big picture ideas you think that need to be better understood within, I guess, the general public about how contemporary world historians are really thinking about world history?
Yeah, I think the nomadic power, nomadic adaptation to the world, nomadic conception of the world is extremely interesting and changed also the way we world historians conceive world history. They were not on the map. They were really seen as either, in the worst case, barbarians, or the one who didn't bring anything to civilization, or the one who cannot change. You know, it's tradition, it's nomads. Oh, it's great, but it's the same since 2000 years. No, everybody who can now go and visit nomadic families everywhere in the world know that, you know, they use Wi-Fi and, you know, the world, I mean, they have a motorcycle and, you know, things change. So it was very interesting to show that both two things. One was to show, okay, this was a great period of globalization. This is very interesting for exchange, for art developments. It's not about war only, certainly. The other interesting thing was to work on why they were disregarded or agent of civilization. Why for so long in European historiography, nomads were had the bad, you know, the dark, were the dark side of humanity, you know? And we always, some colleagues work on that until today. I have question about it, you know, why, where? Because now people think, okay, it's obvious that the Mongols changed so many things and brought so many things beyond war, you know. It's, we have produced so many books and showed so many sources that people are convinced. We don't have, you know, this discussion anymore. But now the question is, how come we didn't see it? How come it was erased from school books and everything? So, and here, of course, we know that there's a sad tribute to a colonial period, during which nomads or like natives were not well seen, obviously, and civilization come from cities, you know, this idea, and also of course the nationalist discourses, the way national history was built in Russia, China, in the Middle East also, well, also clearly explained, but also in Eastern Europe where the Mongols were not part of their national history. They didn't like the idea, you know. So they were considered as the bad period of their own history,
Gates of
and you
Europe
know,
sort of concept.
exactly. So that's very interesting to deconstruct this, and to also, I think another important aspect is for long we had the idea that global times were modern times, and everything started in 16th century, 17th century, you know, Columbus period. But now it's very interesting to speak about the global Middle Ages, or say, or my colleagues work on the Vikings also. Say, no, well, there are other global ages, and they are right. And it's very interesting to open up this notion of, pre-modern globalization. How much effort also people at that time put into, traveling, trading, exchanging, and it's very fascinating. So it's a new conception for global history. And now all my colleagues in global history, most of them, they teach something about Mongols or about Vikings or about earlier period, because we cannot say anymore, or everything starts in 16th century. So that's a big change.
Yeah, fantastic. What's been your experience working with colleagues in Mongolia? Because, I actually traveled to Mongolia 20 years ago, went on the Trans-Mongolian Trans-Siberian Railway, and, stayed in a
Wow,
yurt,
I envy
and
you. Wow.
and it was amazing because at some level the landscape sort of reminded me of Australia, like the I mean not the to some degree the Gobi Desert, and but also just the huge sweeping grasslands, but there were no fences. And it was I think it was bef it was I think it was around about the time that I was there, which was like 2003 or something, that they were just starting to sort of put in fences and limit the sort of
I see.
nomadic movements within the country. But what's been your experience of working with contemporary Mongolians about this aspect of their history, including with the exhibition that you've just recently helped stage in France?
Well, that this is a well, I had a very very, very interesting experience, most in terms of friendship and in intellectual terms as well. So it's true that there are more fences than before now in Mongolia, but still nomads are very important, and it's a center of their identity, and they are still a lot of connection with between the countryside, what they call countryside, which is for us a steppe, and wide areas and cities, which exist. Ulaanbaatar is a real city. So I think my experience there was amazing. I had the chance to work with archaeologists, historians, with from all generation, and I appreciate the freedom of speech, first of all, the fact that I was never told not to say that, or not to promote this or do that. So this is one thing. The other thing that amazed me is in Mongolia today, most scientists, historians, they speak several languages. They speak English, they speak Russian, they speak German, or they read these languages. And I would love to say the same for my country. So I'm impressed by their ability to be turned to the outside world, but they still want to reach the outside world, and they are really open to a lot of exchange, also scientific exchange. The other thing is, I think important moment in Mongolia now, they are really rewriting their national history. After Soviet Union, they were the legacy of the Soviet legacy in terms of national history for Mongolia was really bad. It was, we, you Mongol people, you were barbarians. You were so lucky that the Russian came and helped you to become civilized. And they learned that at school. And I think now with the new generation, born after the 90s in Mongolia, this discourse cannot stand anymore. And people, but still, they know that it cannot stand, but you have to provide something else. And we are all working, me and my colleagues in Mongolia, to provide a new narrative, more accurate, more very different from what they've learned. So in this new narrative, Genghis Khan certainly has a place, but it's not only about him. It would be a mistake to focus on the hero. That's one thing. The other thing is the Mongol Empire obviously is much bigger than Mongolia today. It's so actually for them, it's very interesting because the identity transformed completely when they understand that they were in what is Iran, Western Iran today, in Tabriz and Baghdad. They were Mongols, and many people don't know that in Mongolia because they didn't learn that at school. So that's why we're working on exhibit. It's interesting because through objects, you can make people understand many things. When I show objects that were produced in Tabriz, for instance, and which are Mongol, and you can see also influence from, our craftsmen from China or Iran, and this is a Mongol object at the end. I think for French people, it's amazing, but also for people in Mongolia, it's amazing. So the idea is really to make those exhibit travel, like to make them traveling. So I think in many countries, when you see objects, like seeing a manuscript for with your own eyes, a concrete object, it's moving, and it speaks to you. So, I mean, very lively research. Also in archaeology, they are discovering new object, new artifact, and it's important because most of the most beautiful object were taken by the Russian and are at the Hermitage now. So, like the big Genghis Khan stone, the biggest thing artifact from Genghis Khan's period is at the Hermitage. So they have a very nice facsimile, but still. So archaeology, it's important because it's giving us the opportunity to have more to show in their museum and to understand better their past. So I think that's very important for the population.
And as you say, the hoard is a story about like many, many parts of the world across, you know, Central Asia, southern Northern Eurasia, and obviously into you know some of the areas of conflict today in Ukraine, etc., as well.
Exactly. It's really where, the conflict is now between Russia and Ukraine. All this area was one of the center of the horde. When so my book was recently translated into Mongolian language, and that was really interesting to interact with people about this period of history, and they realized, oh, okay, certainly we've been under Russian power and pressure for a long time, but first we, were the rulers for a long time too in what is Russia today, and it's not so well known, in fact, and it's interesting to see how, I think it's important to see that to understand for younger generation that the world as it is today was not exactly the same before and can be different tomorrow, So let's think about the effect of this for tomorrow.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And the narrow nationalistic history lens from whichever nation it is rarely a accurate insight
Terrible.
into history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you working on another book? Oh, actually, I should share one piece of trivia which you may or may not know. Marie, I've got a picture there, just in the back there, of the Russian poet Anna Akhmatova. Do you know her?
Anna
Is
Akhmatova, yes.
And I read recently that you know her surname is a pen
Ahmad,
name.
yes.
And it's after Akhmat, one of the rulers of the Horde. Did you know that? And
Oh,
that
wow. I wasn't
and
sure it
that
was this
and the
Ahmad,
reason
but
she
yes.
chose it was because I think on her mother's side or her grandmother's side, she claimed direct descendants from the Genghis's from Ahmad himself. So that's why she chose that.
I see.
Did
No,
you
I
know that?
wasn't sure. No. I thought she had this connection with some Tatar lineage, and but I wasn't sure this. Okay. No, thank you so much. As I love her poetry, but I and then suddenly it's very interesting. But it's true that this is part of, I mean, Russia's history. This is the most important and interesting pages of Russian history. So it's so important that actually, also this Muslim part of Russia's history, women studied, should be known, and also because many people in Russia still today they are interested in this period. So either they make connection, personal family connection, or they are interested, and so they, but we need to have books that can, provide accurate, clear information about this period of history. It's extremely important. I think this is our way, we historians, to fight against obscurantism and
Absolutely.
war.
And that's certainly what you do in your book, Marie. So thank you so much for
Thank you so much for
that.
having me.
Are you working on another book at the moment?
Well, so I just finished my work on the exhibition, and now I think I will use more object in my next research, and I probably will work on even more on what I call Mongol Islam. I think the relationship between the Muslim world and the Mongols also needs to be explained, and there are a lot of sources that I'm studying now that can also make us understand how strong the connection were. And it's also interesting to see how important in Mongolia for Mongolian people today the Arabic world and the Islamic world is, because and they rediscover this ancient connection, and they are interested too. And also how Islam was different at that time. That's also a very interesting question I would like to work on.
Fantastic. Is there a book you'd recommend to, I guess, understand that sort of period of Islamic history from,
Well, what would I
Because,
recommend?
often, it's sort of, at least in the, Anglo world, it's very, it's not really well presented, I guess. And it feels like it's just one big black box. And I don't know if you have a recommendation for
Yeah, you're
the
right.
general
That's
reader.
why I also want to work on this differently, because we have two, there are two books, but they're a bit technical probably. One is Genghis Khan by Michal Biran. She's professor at the in Jerusalem at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and she worked a few years ago a biography of Genghis Khan, but in connection with the Muslim world. So I work on this book very often with my students, because it's very interesting to see the image of Genghis Khan in the Muslim world also. We have a more book that brings like the big picture, but also like high level history by Peter Jackson. It's about, so I don't remember the exact title, but something like The Mongol and the Islamic World. Which is, but there are interesting, very interesting pieces in it. And beside, and we can also look at, well, I'm thinking about English, because we have obviously things in other languages, but also, but I think with these two books, you can have very important, I mean, accurate, good information. Sometimes maybe if bit technical, but very, very good. So, but now, yeah, we are working on having, I'm working on having something more accessible. And I mean, it's interesting how to explain why, in a way, Mongol has this reputation of destroying Baghdad and the Abbasid Caliphate, but how at the same time we have to explain how Islam flourished under the Mongols just after this period. So it's something that needs to be explained.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Marie. It's been a fabulous interview. Is there
Thank
anything,
you.
any sort of final words you wanted to say about the
Well,
Horde?
I would, what can I say? I would say that I'm so happy that so many people are now interested in Mongolian history and Mongol Empire, and also going to Mongolia. I mean, I think it's part of what we should promote as we scholars too. It's like you have to, if you can, just don't stick to Google and go and travel. I say that to my student all the time. It's safe country. You will see monuments, you will see museums, you will see people there, and we have to maintain our connections, because this is a world history, as you said. It's, we shouldn't see it as a history of some other people we don't know. It's part of our human past. So that's what I would like to say to
Yeah.
as a hand word, you know.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Well, thank you, Marie. I'll just
Thank you so much.